Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
All righty. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have an amazing founder joining us, a founder that has done it before. Now he's on a rocket ship. We're going to be talking about it, too. He had a really nice exit, you know, the last one. But again, you know, fantastic opportunity here to learn about capital raising, building, scaling, exiting. So all of the good stuff that we like to hear. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Sky Kurtz. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Alejandro. Pleased to be here.
So originally born in Florida, but you moved to quite a bit. You know, your dad was in the military. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
Interesting. So I have a big family. I grew up, started in Florida, then to Jerome, Arizona. So a tiny town in the mountains, 440 people, famous for kind of hippies and music and bikers. And my family there owned a restaurant. So I grew up working in a restaurant with my family. And then eventually we had some financial hardship and had to move to Phoenix, Arizona, pursuing work. And there I finished high school there, ultimately was a scholarship student and got a scholarship to Arizona State University, where I studied business there. I studied finance and economics. And of course, it was a wonderful place to go to school, famous for its weather and you know, fun travel. 4 hours from Vegas, 6 hours from Los Angeles, never hurt. I ended up after that, I left Arizona State and went to Lehman Brothers in New York.
Even before that, I mean, I think that there is a, I think that the way that you grew up and what you saw too, no? I mean, obviously being able to see your parents working super hard, working at the restaurant, also for you to be able to see the hardships. I'm sure that that really shaped who you are today, no? Like being able to see your parents going through uncertainty, through the tough moments like that. How was that for you? And how do you think that made who you are today?
It's been a huge contributor. I think we've all read the stories about grit and about and also about, you know, how hardship shapes people and kind of forges a lot about their character. I think that's, I'm somebody where that's very true. My father pretty much raised me. My mom had some difficulties and ultimately had a period of her life where she served in prison. And so my father was the caretaker for the family. So very much his values and his work ethic and his selflessness, you know, was shaped a lot about me. And when the kids, we took care of each other. We were like a little tribe. And I would say that it shaped me heavily. I'd also say, though, it gave me a bit of a chip on my shoulder. You know, I always had this undying desire to kind of get out of hardship. And, you know, I would say even early on, and, you know, a singular pursuit of economic freedom, you know, just thought poverty was difficult and shameful and hard. And I didn't want to be in that world anymore. So I'd say that that period of life shaped me, you know, hugely. I'd say it also gave me a bit of humility. You know, I had, especially early on, working in restaurants. I worked at the International House of Pancakes for 7 years, all the way through high school and then all the way into college. And in fact, the IHOP scholarship helped fund my university education. So I was serving my classmates and colleagues, you know, all the way through in high school from the lunchroom. And then in college from IHOP. And so that was always challenging, but also on the other hand, led to its own set of experiences and a lot of hell. When I went to investment banking my first year, a lot of people thought, God, these hours are horrible. And admittedly, I was like, well, not college was worse because I was studying and working and trying to have a social life and burning the candle on every end. So yeah, I think, Alejandro, it's been an interesting go. I think I mentioned this to you when we were speaking, but I was the first to graduate high school or college in my family. So I was somebody who put a huge premium on education. I thought it was kind of the way to get out. And, you know, if you just worked hard enough and had good academic credentials, you could open up any door. And I had a lot of people that supported me to do that. You know, a lot of teachers that sort of were surrogate parents when things were difficult at home, you know, had a, you know, and were mentors, right? And kind of guiding and coaching me forward. So yeah, it definitely shaped me, right? I think it's something I'll never escape fully, but on the other hand, it's also made me a lot of who I am.
Yeah, no kidding. Now, in your case, you know, basically, as you were alluding to it, you went into the investment banking, you know, not a lot of people, you know, that made it to Lehman, you know, from a state university. So that's really spectacular. But after Lehman, you went to now, you know, a private equity firm that, you know, spun out of JP Morgan, but it was basically JP Morgan, which kind of like was the segue to a pivotal moment for you, which was really going to Stanford. I guess, at what point do you realize there in JP Morgan, hey, you know, maybe I need to, you know, do my master's and perhaps, you know, get my feet wet more on the business and, you know, that kind of stuff?
Actually, I'd say it was much earlier. When I was young, I always had this sort of life vision that eventually I would get to either a law degree, which I know you did, a law degree, or to a master's program. But I wanted to go to an elite university. I didn't know which one. Admittedly, back then, I didn't even know who Stanford was. I was at the time thinking it'd be Harvard or Yale or Princeton or somewhere. I just knew I wanted to go somewhere that was sort of the best, whatever that was. And ironically, when I can't pretend I had some noble cause or belief in why I went to banking, or in the first place, it was that I just was at that time singularly focused on you know, earning money and getting out of poverty. And so I thought, you know, hey, I hear in Wall Street there's a lot of money. I want to do that, whatever that is. And so when I got there, once I realized I was like, maybe this career in banking isn't for me forever. That's when I started to really think about what are the right programs. And when I found out what the most competitive programs were and started to learn of the character of the different MBA programs, that's when I applied to Stanford. And getting in, it was it's obviously a very competitive program. It was a huge honor, you know, extremely humbling and what an awesome place. I mean, it's never Neverland, you know, it's a gorgeous campus, deer running around, surrounded by brilliant people and in a lovely place to live. But also, I would say that prior to joining Stanford, though my career now has been in technology and afterward I left to tech investing, but I was sort of a technophobe. I actually thought I was a bit out of place in Stanford. I, even in private equity, I was the guy working in industries like, you know, chemicals and consumer goods and industrials. And I had done one semiconductors investment, but pretty much had never really touched tech. And so I was sort of a dinosaur there. But I would say that it was an awesome experience, right? I knew that I wanted, and I had this focus of getting an elite degree and getting into I call it the club, but this powerful network that comes with these universities and the kind of culture and heritage around them. But the truth is, what was challenging, Alejandro, is that I never really planned my life after that. Like I found once I graduated school, I sort of lost what true north was anymore. Like I had this from like 8 years old, this vision to what I'd be by 30. And then when I hit that, I was kind of standing there like, what's next? You know, so I ultimately graduated Stanford and went back to private equity investing, but at a tech investment firm, Francisco Partners, which by the way, is a very special firm, remarkable performance, a really unique model about private equity. I learned a ton there, but I would say that I found I was burning out. I wasn't, you know, certain about who I wanted to be or where I wanted to go. And that's when I eventually left to become an entrepreneur. But I think, again, at the time, I was floundering a bit. I'm somebody who I think is quite mission-driven. I need a purpose. I need a quest. And if I don't have that, I'm lost, you know, even self-destructive. And so I ultimately found that once I had left that, part of what I think I've really enjoyed about becoming an entrepreneur is this quest, right? Whatever your business is and its mission. And I tend to be focused on mission-driven businesses, but I think any business can be a mission. But I would say that I find that that's been giving me that true north, right? It helps give me a focus, which shapes everything about my life, my productivity, my character. So I think it's been a really interesting journey.
Now, in that sense, you know, for you, I mean, you were at Francisco Partners, you start to realize, I mean, you see some of your classmates, you know, you had like six unicorns, you know, in your year, which is incredible. I mean, some of the ones that I actually have the lack of knowing personally, remarkable people. But I guess, what was that triggering moment where you're like, I'm giving my notice and I'm going to travel around, you know, and obviously that ended up taking you to New Zealand. We changed everything for you.
I would say that I think the pivotal, I was thinking about it a lot, even in grad school. I actually remember feeling this sense of like shame and envy when I was sitting in a class called, The Formation of New Ventures. And it was taught by Andy Ratcliffe, who's a legendary investor and entrepreneur. And I remember sitting in that class, and at one point, Andy once asked everybody, how many of you are going to be entrepreneurs and start companies? And literally like everyone but four people in the class raised their hand. And I was one of the four that didn't. And I remember having this thought of like, how is it every one of these people has some disruptive big idea and I don't? And thinking I'm such a failure because I truly thought, yeah, I would love to be an entrepreneur. But I think at the time, I didn't really understand, you know, that the things I know now about how to identify a problem and build a company around it, et cetera. I was sort of sitting there thinking I had to have some Facebook level inspiration. And if I didn't, there was no business to build. So I would say that, Alejandro, that was when I started to think that feeling of, you know, when you have a coin toss and whichever side it lands on, you know what you really wanted to decide. I had a moment in that room, a break where I was like, God, you know, I really want to raise my hand. And I just didn't have an idea. So I didn't. Well, then when I went into investing, I kind of continued to feel like I was hearing about classmates. My classmates also built Relate IQ, if you remember, and I was close to some of these guys. And I watched them build that company and in a relatively short time frame have a fantastic outcome, building a cool product too. And I was just like, once again, I've missed out. What am I doing? So that moment, I think, when I eventually said it's time, was really driven by a bit of when I was saying I was self-destructive. I was just not happy. I was working like 80, 100 hours a week doing a lot of investments and then sitting there thinking, how am I in such a bad place? Like, how am I so miserable? How am I drinking too much? You know, I was just not proud of my behavior and who I was becoming. And I think that's when I thought, you can't possibly be working this hard, sacrificing this much, earning this well, and be miserable and then believe you're in a good place. So that's when that was the moment when I said, something's got to change. You've got to take this in your control and find a new mission.
How do you find yourself all of a sudden in New Zealand?
Actually, I had a few places on a bucket list that if I ever had free time and a bit of money, where would I be? And it wasn't just New Zealand. I went to Alaska. I went silver salmon fishing in Alaska.
Oh my God.
So I'm not kidding. I was, you know, when people say they go on that pursuit of like, you know, finding themselves and finding the world, I was very much doing that. I went to Alaska, went to New Zealand, went to Istanbul. So I traveled a bit and just sort of on adventures, seeing some friends, going to see some natural, beautiful things, skiing in Queenstown, et cetera. And then what happened is one of my classmates from grad school, actually, he's a serial founder himself, and he's a dear friend, Zach Holdsworth. He founded Hint Health, which had a reasonable outcome as well. Zach's family had a business in North Island of New Zealand. And I met them, and that's what actually got me involved in this composite materials business. That was it was this really innovative technology that was developed by a gentleman, this Peter Holdsworth, and it was just this kind of mad scientist, brilliant chemist, who developed this novel composite material that could replace steel in infrastructure. So think of a resin and glass product that, when put together, was stronger than steel, lighter than aluminium, and it never rusts. And I thought, if that product really has those properties, it has a pretty significant global potential market. Began to engage with the company and then eventually joined it and helped to lead and build that company. And that was so in a weird way, the opportunity found me as part of my travels and being open to the world. The universe sent me opportunities. And I think in some ways, that's one of the best ways to find really authentic ideas, is like get out there, spend time. I think I told you this too, Alejandro, my second business, Vents. Vents was because I was in New Zealand living on a sheep farm and going out and about and seeing how they have farmed in these very traditional methods, even in the most sophisticated industrial farms available. But, you know, dogs chasing sheep and ATVs and shock prodders. And I thought there must be a better way. In the day of a smart watch, there must be a technology that could digitize this. And that sent me on my second journey, right? So really that trip, that sort of go find myself trip, led to a lot of foundational things. And even on Pure Harvest, the company I run today.
And we'll talk about that one real quick. But I want to ask you the first one, you know, that you did, you know, on that one, you know, basically you ended up getting that acquisition. You guys sold it to Saudi Aramco. And then the next one, you know, again, sold it to Merck. So it's like a really nice batting average here, you know, and the one to Merck, that was a transaction for $125 million. So not bad. So I'm wondering, what kind of visibility did you have from the first transaction that helped you during the process of selling to Merck? And how was that process of selling to such a large company like Merck and getting, you know, a nice outcome like that?
Well, Merck had been courting the company for some time. Merck has an animal health division that is, essentially leverages their global brand, their R&D capabilities, their global distribution, and their capital base. And then the idea that a solution like Vents could be essentially another tool in the tool chest to sell made a lot of sense, right? We thought they could be a natural acquirer. But I think that one, maybe reflecting on for viewers of the podcast, advice is that I think I'm kind of against, and maybe it's because my DNA and my heritage as a prior, you know, growth and private equity investor. People always say, don't think about the exit, you know, just build your business. And I find that advice to be a bit colloquial. I actually disagree. I think you need to be cognizant if you're going to take private capital to scale a business, that the business model of that capital is that you ultimately need to return it, right? You need to sell the business or go public or find some way to bring new shareholders in to acquire the old shareholders. So I think it's actually quite fundamental to be thinking about what are the potential paths to exit for this business? And is what I'm building attractive to some new investor base, whether that's a strategic, another financial investor, at what stage? Because if you're not thinking about that as an element of what you're building, then you may not be building the right thing. Something that's, you could build even a really interesting business that isn't marketable to anybody. There's no investor universe that can absorb it. And I think in the market that I'm in now in the Middle East, that's a common thing. People build interesting and profitable businesses that have no market. And I think they're not thinking enough about it. So I guess the lesson from that, Alejandro, is I think we were cognizant that they could be a potential acquirer and also mindful of remaining close and in touch with them. And I think that it would be my advice to many founders is that you think about that and you start those relationships. You know, I always say that businesses are bought, not sold. And so you ultimately need to be engaging with those. You need to be engaging with those parties long before you're thinking of exiting. If you're ultimately saying, okay, we've built enough profit, enough scale, and our investors want to see an exit, and now you're beginning to think about that and starting to court buyers, you're probably quite late and you're probably going to achieve a suboptimal outcome.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then in this case for you, I mean, once the transaction was done, you started, you know, what is arguably your biggest success to date, no? Which is with Pure Harvest. And with this company, also you're tackling something that, you know, is allowing you to kind of like ride that wave, you know, of the consciousness around climate and, you know, things like that. So how did the idea of the company come to mind? And obviously now this is the third go at it. So you're very clear as to when to really validate something, how to think about the market and potential execution. So what was that journey like where you were like, this is a no-brainer. I gotta take action here.
Well, actually, interestingly, the problem for Pure Harvest, I had witnessed when I was still with the first business, Pultron Composites, in the Middle East, but literally had gone to the grocery stores and experience being a consumer there, where there were really two alternatives when you went to buy produce. And I had come from California, which is like the produce basket of America, right? I was accustomed to readily available, good quality, reasonably priced produce. And I'm someone who really enjoys that for health reasons, but also just love the flavor of fruits and vegetables. And when it was there, the moment you put some things in your basket, you really have two choices. Either there's expensive air freighted imports that are of good quality, usually from Europe or Tunisia, Morocco, or there's regional or local low quality seasonal production, sometimes of very questionable quality and safety. And really, there was nothing in between. And so I thought there has to be a better way. Like if you could use technology to leverage all that free sunlight and the other factors of production there that are really attractive, you should be able to build, you should be able to be profitable. And my understanding from, I think I mentioned this to you, my father, I grew up, he worked in climate, right? He was essentially doing cooling systems for things like Intel Corporation or universities. So these powerful refrigerant tools that would essentially manage climate in these unique manufacturing environments and R&D environments. And so I learned a lot about cooling from that. And I thought in my head, there's absolutely a way to cool a food, you know, a greenhouse or a food production system. It's just going to come to capital and energy of whether this makes sense. And that's what gave me the sort of the, I guess, authenticity to understand there might be a solution to tackle this. And then that it would just be a work of understanding the technology and then developing the you know, building up the bill of materials and what would be your production cost to say, is there a market for this, right? That's what set me on that journey. But one other thing, Alejandro, on Vents, I should clarify. I actually founded Vents and then Pure Harvest only about 10 months apart. And for a period of time, I actually tried to lead both businesses. And I was trying to, I always joke that if someone like Elon Musk can do it, we can all do it. I now realize that's crazy. I don't know how he does so many businesses because I thought two was incorrigible. And I was struggling to perform on both and to manage the time zones and the challenges. So ultimately, actually, we brought on board a co-founder who led the business and as CEO, a guy named Frank Wooten. So I actually stepped back from Vents, from leading it day to day, and moved to leading Pure Harvest because I couldn't lead both. So I wanted to clarify when you were asking about, it wasn't in sequence. They were actually simultaneous. And then, of course, I think there was a powerful learning for me, though, and for my board. I wouldn't recommend somebody found multiple companies at once. I think it's a huge challenge and it comes with great risk.
It is.
But on Pure Harvest, though, that's actually how the idea happened, right? And I ultimately, I was quite living the problem of tasting, you know, the quality of the produce and the cost challenges and thought, if we could build a tool to solve this, we could have a big company.
So for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of Pure Harvest? How do you guys make money?
So we're a technology-enabled agribusiness. So we are vertically integrated in that we design, procure, construct, and then we operate the farms. And so we farm, we're farmers, but then we market, sell, and distribute the produce as well. So fully integrated into our supply chain. And we have a consumer brand, really a house of brands. So we actually brand the produce and engage, you know, with consumers in social media, in traditional FMCG or marketing style, if you will. And we ultimately are now a branded consumer product, right? We've also launched new product lines. We trade some produce. So we do almost like certified free trade in coffee. We'll leverage our powerful brand in the region and our agronomical prowess and credentials. And we'll go evaluate farmers and then ultimately certify them, you know, their you know, global GAP certification, their treatment and ethical treatment of labor. And then we'll ultimately, once we bless that product, we'll sell it into the market in a brand we call Pure Harvest Selections. So it's our curated products into the market. And then also we've launched what we call value-added products, but we leverage our brand and our access into the retailers. And we built a line of pasta sauces. So think Rao's, which we might be familiar with here, but we're doing products like chili cherry and a cherry passata. We do a shakshuka. So really beautiful products that are made from our ugly tomatoes and products. And now we're launching a line of jams. So things like a strawberry jam. We're doing one that's strawberry, dates, cinnamon, and cardamom. So really unique products that are authentic to the palate of our regional consumers who like dates. And so we've launched new product lines that are really building upon the foundation of the company as a farmer. So how we make money is really building or farming products and, of course, then making them, attractive, high-value consumer products, and then engaging with markets and selling them mainly to retail, but also we sell online and through hotels, restaurants, and catering.
And also, how much capital have you guys raised to date? And what has been the journey of going through raising the money?
So we've raised $287 million of capital to date in a combination of equity, debt, and some grants. And the journey's been interesting, and that's been one of the harder lessons, I would say, for me in my entrepreneurial journey. If I knew what I knew today, I would have started the company for just one day in Silicon Valley with my Stanford baseball cap on and then launched in the Middle East, because it has been challenging to be a Middle East company that was first of its kind, in a relatively, young and emerging entrepreneurial ecosystem and capital ecosystem, but to be first of its kind, asset intensive, agriculture technology, onshore. And what I mean by that is in our region, there's these free zones where you can own 100% of your business. But when you go into it, when you come out of the free zones into Sharia law and into the local lands, there's a wholly different legal framework and complexity that comes with that. And so the complexity of the business was, huge, highly capital intensive, highly complex, building a brand. And really that's been, that made capital challenging. That first raise was quite difficult, right? I had to raise $5.8 million to build not only a pilot, the MVP, if you will, but then of course the working capital needed to build the, essentially to farm, buy all the packaging materials, build the channels to market. And that was extremely, at the time, it was the largest ever seed financing in the Middle East, North Africa, right? So it was bloody brutal. I went, kind of friends, family, and fools, if you will, of classmates from business school, people that I used to work with in private equity who were saying, hey, I believe in you and I'll back you. And that's how we kind of, cobbled together the money to get that first build done. But once we had proved it, people saw the product quality, which is award-winning. I mean, we literally won the equivalent of the Michelin star of tomatoes in a Belgian international taste competition. And so once you saw the quality of the product branded on the shelf and that we had acquired shelf space in some of the top retailers in the region, then people knew there was something there and they could see the unit economics. And then we started to scale and raise, greater and greater capital. But I think that when you asked about lessons learned, I think that one thing is being really mindful of the sort of, I call it the Plinko chip of who can invest in this. When you think about if you're in a new region, especially in an emerging market, and there are not powerful and sizable incumbent capital bases that can serve such a business model, it can be challenging, right? We even had to create securities. I mean, I never thought I'd be putting my Lehman structured finance hat back on, but I did so. We won an award for developing essentially a Sukuk, which is a Sharia compliant bond that was essentially venture debt. So I had to create a security that was a project financing structured as a bond in Sharia compliance. And then we won awards for it for financial market innovation. But I didn't think I'd have to create securities to fund my own business with non-dilutive capital in the Middle East. But that was something we had to do. So I think that in a weird way, it's almost like I was made for this because I had this background in being able to navigate complex financings to secure capital for a capital intensive business. On the other hand, it was bloody brutal and a massive distraction from building the core business.
So in all, you guys have raised, close to $300 million, right? And you have like 550 employees. I mean, it's incredible. Also, whether it's customers or investors, they're always betting on a vision, right? So if I was to ask you, you go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of the company is fully realized, what does that world look like?
We are building a truly global controlled environment agriculture company. So we're technology agnostic, meaning we're not monolithic about the tool that will farm, but ultimately about the outcome. A world where high quality, safe, sustainably grown and affordable produce is available everywhere. And that's where I'm a big believer that people talk a lot about food security. But that's food security is about survival. That's carbohydrates, right? That's a different piece of the calorie pyramid. What we're after more is food system resilience and specifically after quality of life, right? Ultimately, I want people to do more than be secure and live. I want them to thrive. And I think that to do that, when you think about nutrition, really fruits and vegetables is a key portion of that equation. both for health and longevity, right? It's proven that a lot of the folks who live over 100 years eat a lot of fruit and veg and a relatively lower calorie diet, right? That's done through high quality, you know, diverse, delicious, fresh produce available and stuff that doesn't have a lot of chemicals, stuff that's not killing our planet. And then ultimately, water. I think that the story of food, and people talk a lot about carbon and food miles, but really, we're gonna struggle with water long before carbon becomes the thing that's driving our food outcome, because we're already seeing the water wars beginning in America around the Colorado River. The Yangtze River in China is drying up. And these are places that these water bases feed huge amounts of the fields that supply fruits and veg to America and to China, right? So I guess when you ask what the vision is, it would be that the world is adopting technologies that enable us to produce with much greater resource efficiency, a lower environmental impact, lower resource utilization, but high quality, safe, sustainable, and affordable produce available for everyone.
I love it. Now we're looking into the horizon, no? But I want to put you now into a time machine and bring you back in time. You know, I bring you back in time, you know, maybe to that moment where you were about to make your trip to, let's say, New Zealand, yeah, back in 2014 or so, and get into the venture world as an entrepreneur. And let's say that moment where you're giving your notice at Francisco Partners and you're just walking out of the office, and right there on the spot, you see that younger self coming out of the office and you're able to give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
I call it the rule of 40. I'm thinking about this because I gave an answer to a different question, but it comes to a similar answer, which is whatever you're going to do is a plan and resource for the ability that it takes 40% longer than you think it will. Cost 40% more, right? And that you plan it could go 40% better than you think it will, or 40% worse. Because I think that interestingly, we all have, and I particularly have, I know, optimism bias, but also this sort of the consequence of that optimism can be dire in terms of if you, for example, don't resource appropriately and you ultimately end up in some strife and situation, it can be quite brutal. It can have great personal sacrifice to solve the problems, and it's not needed. So I think that the advice I would give is whatever you're going to go on in that journey, if you're going to go be an entrepreneur, is that really think of that 40 rule. Whatever you're doing, you're under planning, you're being too optimistic. And I would say that had I had that advice, so many things would have been different. For example, the strife and challenges that were created by my overlap of founding two companies, believing I could manage both, I would have planned that both of them required 40% more time and energy. I would have done the math and said that can never work. And because that had huge consequences on me personally and on my wife, my family, when I was working like that and you know, wasn't able to be present. Another example, at Pure Harvest, when we started the first build, we had planned, you know, a certain level of yields ramping over 3 years. But in the first months, we were hitting higher yields than we ever thought possible in the third year of the model. We had run the model, if you went down 40%, and what would you do and how would you manage cash? But we never ran it if you went up, if you outperformed your highest expectations possible. And interestingly, in a things business, you need working capital, you need packaging, you need labor, you need people to harvest it. And I was literally, I had to exhaust all of my personal wealth and every loan I could get my hands on to keep the lights on while we could raise a bridge amount of capital to fund the growth that we were experiencing. So we almost got killed by a high-class problem, right? You can grow yourself into bankruptcy too. And that's an example of where, you know, just that rule of 40 would have saved me a lot of trouble. That was an extremely stressful time. And again, great personal sacrifice for not only me, my team, right? The incredible effort that we all had to do to survive that. And ironically, it was a good problem to be having. But even if you want to raise capital, you can't do it in a day, right? It takes time. So I would say that my advice would be that humility to stare at whatever plans you have and however well you think you know your plan and test it with that rule of 40. And I think that if you create that space, you'll be able to perform better. You'll be able to kind of under-promise and over-deliver to commitments to investors and partners and others. And you'll be able to kind of protect yourself, right? Your health, your quality of life, your ability to deliver on your commitments. And I think that's the advice I would have given myself.
Amazing. So, Sky, for the people that are listening, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Best would be LinkedIn. I'm a bit traditional. I'm active on Instagram, but not so much. I'm a bit lazy on social media. Less than I'd admit. I would also say email these days I'm overwhelmed with, so probably not best. I think LinkedIn would be best, and I'll try to get back to you. I would also say, though, if anyone comes through the Middle East, do reach out. We certainly love welcoming people. It's an exciting time and an exciting place. There's a massive economic boom, as you know, happening in the Middle East. I think you were just there for the FII. But I would say I would encourage people to make it a place that they spend a little time. It's an exciting place to be building businesses and also to, of course, visit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Sky, for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Alejandro. Great to be here and love what you're doing and so happy to support.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.